accession number 27177, Reel 5.
Tony Swainson, Reel 5.
Last thing about recruitment was the only other contribution I made, which I'm rather proud of, was I suddenly realised that the naming of ships had an enormous effect on recruitment, and we used to bring out smaller ships after the war, and frigates were given sort of obscure names like New Key and Tenby and after Hunts and like Bleasdale and Bicester and so on. And I realised then that the important thing was to revive all our big HMS London, HMS Birmingham, HMS whatever, Newcastle, and big city names. And so I got this managed through by the Admiralty, and then ships came out then with big city names, so that the contact was with large populations rather than small little villages, and it made a small effect on recruitment, which I was rather pleased with. I was actually able to change the names of some of our ships. Astonishing. After that I went to Malta GC. Don't forget they were given the George Cross, that wonderful island that survived the war. I was sent there as commander of HMS San Angelo, which was the naval base there, but of course sadly it was in the middle of the rundown. Malta was, many books have been written about the wartime heroism when the German and Italian forces bombarded the island incessantly, and remember of course there were three hurricanes on the island, Faith, Hope and Charity. And we had a flag officer, Malta, Dudley Davenport, and I was commander at San Angelo, and Tubby Crawford, who was the commodore, was also at San Angelo. We lived in a lovely old house on Dockyard Creek called Wharf House. It was famous as a captain of the galleys house in the days of the Knights of Malta in the 16th century. So it was very, very old and really rather impressive. The island was steeped in history and we were now part of it. We had a lovely walled garden backing onto the original capital, which was Vittoriosa, now usurped by the Siege of Malta in 1565. Ernie Bradford's book on Malta is well worth reading, actually, on the Great Siege. There was a coastal minesweeper squadron berthed there whilst we were in Malta, and they played a significant role when there was a serious earthquake in Sicily during our stay. Malta's history, of course, with the opening of the Suez Canal in 1869, Malta became strategically significant. And in World War II, as I've already said, it suffered heavy Axis bombing, but it was never subdued. Many naval and merchant ships were lost in supplying Malta. Convoy after convoy would sail from the UK as they rounded jib into the Med, were nearly all sunk. And the survival rate was very low. Convoys sail from Liverpool, they're taking fearful punishment from aircraft and submarines as soon as they entered the Mediterranean. But here we were in peacetime in Malta, having become fully independent in 1964 and a member of the Commonwealth. And I think it was Borja Livio, who was a Conservative MP, who was in power at the time. Nice little man, and we used to have him in the wardroom for lunch occasionally. However, Dom Mintoff, who was a socialist, took over in 71, and he pressed for the early removal of British forces from Malta, and it was called the Rundown. And of course we were right in the middle of it, which had started in 1967 when we arrived. That was to say, the Rundown meant getting rid of all these loyal, lovely Maltese sailors who'd served us throughout the war, and it was a very, very sad occasion to say goodbye to so many of our Maltese friends. It was an unpleasant task, discharging Maltese sailors who'd served the Royal Navy for a long time. And the climate there, of course, was delightful, and the house was a few minutes away from my office looking across Grand Harbour at Lascaris, Flag Officer Malta's headquarters. It was an idyllic way in which to draw to a close my active years in Her Majesty's Royal Navy. During my stay, we had a visit from the Grand Master from Rome, and I held a luncheon for the Maltese Prime Minister Borja Livio. The Italian training ship Amerigo Vespucci paid us a visit. She was a beautiful sail training vessel and a sight to behold. I have one of her ship's crests. commander of San Angelo. I had a motorboat and a crew at my disposal. Most weekends we set sail on what we call barge picnics to Island Bay, a beautiful spot a few miles around the south coast. It was an island bay that I first met Don Mintoff. I used and had several long chats with him when I was looking for sea urchins, which is quite a delicacy. At the end of my Maltese sojourn, I was promoted to captain and sent as head of the British naval mission to Libya. Now, that was under King Idris, and we were digging for oil there, and training their navy, training their army, and relations are very good between Great Britain and the government of Libya. I was sent with my family, was met at Tripoli Airport by a lieutenant commander who was to be my second in command. He told me that King Idris on the throne, it was boom town, he said, and our prospects were bright. That was in the autumn of 1969. The mission was in Tripoli to train the Libyan Navy. My role was also to act as an arms salesman, as there were a number of British shipbuilders on offer. I was promoted to the rank of captain whilst holding the appointment, and shipping one more stripe and increasing my pay was okay with me. But, read on, a few days after my arrival in Tripoli, there was a rat-a-tat in the town square, and the Gaddafi revolution had begun. Idris fled to Egypt, and Captain Gaddafi, self-promoted to colonel, was in charge of the People's Republic. The British naval mission was confined to barracks. I protested to Commander Shakshuki, the head of the Libyan Navy, but he was powerless to do much about it. The oil wells were nationalised, and Sir Donald Maitland, the British ambassador, said, give it 6 months. For 6 months, well, read 20 years plus, and still going strong. Eventually, I told Gaddafi, I went and saw him, and I said if he wanted his ships to sink at their moorings, all he had to do was to keep us confined to barracks. So he gave a wry smile and said, all right, Captain Swenson, get on with the job, which we did. So we went back to work and established normal relations with the Libyan Navy. My immediate boss was the British ambassador, and I attended all the meetings at the embassy, which was quite interesting to have an insight into the workings of the Foreign Office. If anyone thinks the Navy are rank conscious, they'd better have a look at the jolly old Foreign Office. As you will probably appreciate, Libya was a dry country and no booze. However, we got some in through Malta and through the Nelsonian blind eye of the Libyan Navy. They too enjoyed a drink occasionally. One of Gaddafi's private secretaries visited my villa regularly for a whiskey, and needless to say, the British ambassador could never understand why my intelligence was so much better than his. I used to pump this chap for all sorts of information, then go along and tell the ambassador. So that was great fun. Tripoli at the time was full of political intrigue, and the French Air Force attaché, who was trying to sell the Libyans the Mystère fighter, he asked me for a drink one day. I knew he was out to quiz me on my naval activities, and I was not surprised when I had to interrupt the conversation to ask him to switch off his tape recorder. He was highly embarrassed, and I left shortly afterwards, feigning high dudgeon. A typical Anglo-French relationship of distrust, I fear. Another spy episode was when I went to the boot of my car, which I never usually did because I had a chauffeur, and found it all wired for sound. My chauffeur, Ali, confirmed that the military had put it there upon the orders of Gaddafi. I protested to Shakshuki, who gave me a wry smile. What made Tripoli a great place at the time were the Italians, who civilised the place, to be perfectly honest. All the artisans were Italian. You got your shoes repaired, your watch repaired, your whatever. The watchmakers, the boot repairers, and the candlestick makers, they were all Italian. So imagine my shock when Gaddafi issued a decree that all Italians were to leave the country within 7 days. They were a pathetic sight. I saw them all at the dockside with just one suitcase each as they had to leave. It was very, very sad because from there on you could get nothing mended or repaired or anything at all. The Europeans immediately felt the civilizing influence of the Italians. Mind you, the Italians have been particularly brutal towards the Libyans when they seized the country in 1911. The outbreak of World War II, Libya was an Italian colony. It was consequently one of the main battlegrounds of the North African campaign and came under Anglo-French rule in 1943. Revenge was sweet against the Italian colonists. Bruins and Sobrato and Leptis Magnum, we don't want that, do we? Really?
Put it on.
What?
It's of interest.
Now that we have restored relations with Gaddafi, of course, Libya would be the most wonderful, wonderful tourist centre because the beaches are quite magnificent. However, there's one big snag, and that is the country's dry and will remain therefore. And I can't see how you can have tourism without tourists having a drink. But the Roman ruins at Sabrata and Leptis Magna are among the finest in the world. We're very privileged to visit them, especially as tourism was non-existent. The sea bathing, as I've said, from certain spots along the coast was quite wonderful. We also drove to kilometre 13, where we had the beach to ourselves. The sea was unpolluted, with safe swimming. Libya ever opens up to tourism, be extremely popular, but they will have to introduce some booze. After having survived the revolution, got the men back to work, I received the following signal from Rear Admiral Kent, who was the flag officer in Malta, and I read it, I quote it in full, because I'm very proud of it. In the short time I've been here, everyone has told me what a success you've made of the mission in Libya. Your leadership, energy and perseverance are a byword in Malta. Very best of luck in the future from all of us here. I quote this in full. You will gather that I was really rather proud of that signal because, to be perfectly honest, it was a pretty bloody life there and one had to work hard. The Admiral and the Flag Lieutenant paid me an unofficial visit in plain clothes. They sneaked over from Malta, which is only 200 miles north, and they were aware of the difficult circumstances under which we were working, I might add, for my wife and family. We had no contact with the Libyan people, apart from the Navy, who were not particularly friendly. And my wife was accosted by some Libyans on her way home from the shops one day. It was a nasty experience. However, we put up with that, and Sir Donald Maitland was relieved as ambassador by Peter Tripp, who'd come from Singapore. And one day, towards the end of my 2 years, he sent for me. I thought, what have I done wrong now? The proverbial blotting paper. And it was only to tell me that I'd been awarded the Order of the British Empire, as they say, other buggers' efforts, as we used to call it. I was in the London Gazette on the 12th of June and attended the investiture at Buckingham Palace on Tuesday the 16th of November 1971. Having been happily paid off into retirement, one obviously couldn't live on a meagre pension, so we had to look for a job. And you know, it took me, I was 6 months campaigning and went to heaven knows how many interviews, and it's awful to say it, but I could see the chap behind the desk was saying to himself, this fellow wants my job, I'm not going to employ him. And anyway, I didn't get a job for 6 months until I applied for one as the secretary of the Lord's Taverners, which is a charity which a friend of mine was a member of, and a sporting charity. And he said, well, give it a go, Tony, it's quite fun. So I joined this thing in March 1972. Ian Carmichael was the chairman, lovely man, famous actor, very charming. And I thought, well, it was really all nice, but they were paying me $2,000 a year, which wasn't the greatest salary upon which to bring up family. However, I got stuck into the philosophy of the Taverners, and from a staff of one, we were raising $18,000 a year. When I left in 1991, having served for 20 years and been made director, we'd raised, I think it was, 1.5 million. And this was by largely doing various innovative things. We had all sorts of fundraising ideas. I had a deal with P&O. We put stars of stage, screen and radio onto ships, and we go on a cruise, and I get a sum of money from them, and we'd actually found raison board. And dear old Ted Moult, was, God bless him, was so popular with all the people, and so were all these other familiar people, like Eric Morecambe and so on. And I brushed shoulders with all the famous people, which was quite fun, and to see them in their funny, eccentric way of life was an eye-opener for me, because the contrast between service life and, say, being an actor was huge. I think I mentioned that we were largely a sporting charity. We put money into cricket. Now, I realised very early on that cricket per se was not terribly emotive, and it was far better to try and broaden our mission. So I introduced buses for handicapped children, and of course we gave one away in a home in Oxfordshire, and there was a dear man who couldn't get out of his chair, looked up at me and he said, "Sir, you've opened up New Horizons." I realised then that New Horizons was a wonderful name for our buses, so we now have New Horizons Lawstabners buses for handicapped people. And also I introduced sport for the disabled, all kinds of disabled people. I mean, there are blind cricketers and there are basketball players who play out of wheelchairs. And so these two extra categories on our mission statement enabled us to raise much more funds rather than just cricket, all of which, although we love the game. I helped Brian Ricks, who runs been a big wheel in Mencap for years and years and years, and he has a handicapped Charles Shelley, who was at Normansfield, home for the handicapped. And I used to do some voluntary fundraising for him, which I found very rewarding, and he was a very nice man to work for. We were very dependent, the Tabblers, upon benefactors, and there was one chap, very nice man, called Raphael Ginobili, who was a sort of millionaire fella, and he said, "I want to go to Australia to watch a test match." And I said, "Well," he said, "get me an old test captain." And I thought of Mike Dennis and one or two famous people. And suddenly at the end of this lunch, he turned to me and said, "Have you ever been to Australia, Tony?" And I said, "Yes, of course I have. Been there twice." And so he said, "Right, I want you to come with me." So I realised then what a great opportunity. Australia, a cricketing country. I will set up a Laws Taverners area, region, call it what you will, in Oz. So off we went by Concorde, no less, to Bahrain, 3.5 hours, then up to Singapore, then we chuntered down to Sydney. And I had meetings in Sydney with well-known cricketers, Tenny Gregg and Co, and Arthur Morris, and set up a region there. We called on the mayor of Sydney. Then we flew up to Melbourne and set up an organisation in Melbourne. And I'm now happy to say that every state in Australia has a Laws Taverners branch or section or whatever you call it. I suspect, being Oz, they're probably rather independent, and I think they call themselves the Taverners. But nevertheless, I'm very proud of the achievement that we have now the Taverners in every state in Australia, thanks to that one man who took me over there and paid the bill. I think that almost summarises my life in the service, but there's one thing I did forget to mention, I suspect, and that was immediately after the war, because we had to take back lease-lend ships to the States, had to return everything that we borrowed from them. They're hard taskmasters, I can tell you. And they had to be completely restored with everything that was on the inventory when we took them over for the war effort. And so, having restored this ship, we sailed it back to New York via Las Palmas. And when we got to Brooklyn Navy Yard, to our astonishment, we were told to de-store the ship, everything out onto the jetty, and blow me down after we got a big pile of all the kit, including all the expensive stuff as well, and blankets and all the navigation equipment. They set fire to the whole lot. I could not believe my eyes, and I rushed up and pulled off a couple of blankets for my dear old mum back home, because we needed that sort of thing to keep warm in England. What an astonishing reaction to a lease lend. Oh yes. We obviously weren't very popular with the dockyard mateys there, because all they kept shouting at us was, "Why don't you go home, you lousy Brits?" And we didn't quite understand that, and we just said, because we like it here.
Considering all your experience, your war experiences, what feelings are you left with?
Oh, I see, yes. Well, that's a very good question. I can tell you, I think, without any hesitation now, that I'm very, very anti-war. I'm totally against the war in Iraq. I'm totally against any war because it doesn't appear to solve anything. And all the killing and the wounding and the tragedy and the loss, I think, is unforgivable. We're put on this planet to love one another, and I'm now, I suppose, a pacifist.